This is Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Hundreds of progressive activists from around the country wearing top hats and faux gold tiaras marched to the home of Vice President Dick Cheney last Friday to thank him in person for the generous tax breaks for the wealthy the Bush administration recently pushed through Congress. Gathered in Washington, D.C. for a Take Back America conference, activists heard early campaign speeches from each of the presidential hopefuls. Peace Watch was on hand Friday when the Reverend Al Sharpton spoke of the Democratic Party's position on the invasion of Iraq as a reason to support his candidacy.
First of all, I'm very happy and honored to be here this morning, and I'm very happy to join people that are not afraid to stand up and call themselves progressive at a time like this in American history. I think that the first problem we have facing the election in 2004 is that too many of us have been intimidated into apologizing for being right. There are those that say that we've had to go as a Democratic Party to the right to win. And some got laryngitis as the party went to the right, even though the policies on the right are wrong. But the results are that today we do not control the Senate, the House, the White House, or the Supreme Court. The sellout of progressive politics has been a total disaster for the Democratic Party. Not only is it morally wrong and politically cheap, it doesn't even work. And the folk that brought us into this disaster ought not be the advisors on how to get us out of the mess they brought us in. We're coming out of a war that we still don't know why we went in. I was the first candidate to speak out against the war. Made it to all the marches. Some candidates came late, left early. I opposed the war because I said it was wrong and there were no weapons of mass destruction. They're still looking for the weapons. We want to know, where is the weapons that the Secretary of State brought evidence of before the UN? Where are the weapons that they had the video and the audio tapes? If you could find the weapons before the war, how come you can't reveal the weapons now? I was amazed the other night. I was here in Washington, Bob. And someone ran over to me and said, "Do you have a comment?" I said, "A comment about what?" They said, "They just indicted Martha Stewart." I said, "For what?" They said, "For lying." I said, "I didn't know you can get indicted for lying in this country." We have come out of a war with weapons we can't find. Guided by a president who told us a year and a half ago that we were going to go get bin Laden. He can't find him. We had to go to Iraq to get Hussein. We don't know if he's living or dead. He can't find him. Everything Bush has gone after, he can't find. I shouldn't be surprised because I can't find the votes in Florida that made him the president in the first place. First of all, in the year 2000, The principles of American democracy was undermined. There are those that say we should just get over it. This is the next national election since 2000. What they did in Florida must be answered at the polls in 2004. We don't have 5 votes on the Supreme Court, but we have millions of votes in the 50 states if we go and organize and mobilize and quit imitating the folk that we ought to be getting rid of. The Sharpton platform includes that we must make it a constitutional right to vote. The argument before the Supreme Court in Gore versus Bush was basically Bush said that states control voting. It was a states' rights argument. And the Supreme Court went with that, kicked it back to the state of Florida. Katherine Harris certified the election. The only way to avoid, to prevent on a permanent basis that not happen again is that we are proposing a constitutional amendment to give us the right to vote, empowering the federal government over states. House Joint Resolution 28, House Joint Resolution 29, guaranteeing quality health care for all Americans, and 30, quality education. We cannot just keep arguing with the Republicans about programs without changing the premise. If we made it a constitutional right to health care, we wouldn't be cutting deals in the midnight hours over prescription drugs when our grandma should have a right to drugs in America. Our problem is that we have too many leaders of the party who have been elephants running around with donkey jackets on, thinking that we don't recognize who they really are. You cannot be on both sides of the aisle. You cannot stand up for war in Iraq and occupation in Iraq and spending billions in Iraq when we have 50 states with record state deficits. And they say to us, well, you got to understand, Reverend, we've got to deal with occupying Iraq. What about the 50 states you already occupy? Then Bush proposes a tax cut when it's really a tax shift. Because by cutting as he has, it has caused state budget deficits to increase. So then they tax working class people with higher property tax, higher sales tax, higher mass transit. It's working class tax. They've shifted the burden over to us. And we need to fight back. We don't need to fight back with a lower tax cut. We need to fight back with no tax cut. Put the money back. And use that money around the fundamental aims of this country to give children education, not some children, not privatization schemes, not giving one a voucher, another child a school, give them all quality education. We can afford it if we wanted to. I'm the only candidate that is unilaterally against the death penalty. It is embarrassing that a Republican governor in Illinois showed more moral courage than members of my own party. We need to deal with this. We must have real progressives that are real because they believe it, not just trying a campaign strategy. There's some that are running that have become progressive to distinguish themselves. And then there are others of us that have always been progressive to define ourselves. Many candidates support the civil rights movement. I was on the front line. Many support fighting for labor. I've gone to jail fighting for the right to work. Many supported stopping the bombing in Vieques. I did 90 days. I'm not a liberal supporting progress. I'm a progressive born and bred fighting back. And I'm not asking for your help now. I've always been there. My campaign manager, Frank Watkins, who I met 27 years ago when I was the New York youth director of Reverend Jackson's organization, as I keep meeting these new progressives, I said, Frank, was he in Reverend Jackson's campaign? Nope, just met him. Were they there? Nope, just met him. It's strange to me how people can come to us that scorned us, never walked with us, never supported us, and want to make some last-minute road to Damascus conversions and expect us to support them when we don't even know where they will be in 2005. I urge you, let's not play games with people that have never stood with us before. We can't win unless we build a movement. This can't be a clubhouse race with a nice, pretty resume. We got to go to the streets. We got to go door to door. We got to get the disaffected, the disinherited. We got to get America back so we can take America back. I grew up in New York, but my parents are from the South. I had a grandmother that had a little farm in Alabama. And I remember I used to ask her about different animals because coming out of the urban center, I didn't know that much about it. We didn't have a donkey, but I remember reading about a donkey. And I asked her, how do you handle a donkey? She said, well, donkeys are stubborn. Donkeys sometimes don't obey the will of those around them, but if you slap the donkey, you can make the donkey respond. There are those that say, Reverend, don't raise progressive points. Don't say different things of accountability. That's divisive. I'm not being divisive. I'm trying to slap this donkey. I'm not trying to hurt another candidate. I'm trying to slap this donkey. I'm trying to wake it up. I'm trying to get it up. Because if I can slap this donkey, I can make it kick George Bush out the White House. We gotta slap this donkey till we take America back.
Democratic presidential hopeful Reverend Al Sharpton speaking Friday at the Take Back America conference in Washington, D.C. Israel's military dismantled an uninhibited West Bank settlement outpost today, a first step toward meeting part of its obligation under a U.S.-backed peace plan. The troops tore down the small group of empty trailers of the Nev Eris South outpost, then removed a water tower that made up a nearby outpost called Armona. More than 100 settlers from a nearby settlement blocked the road, preventing soldiers from driving the tower away on a truck. Last week, President Bush met with Palestinian Prime Minister Mahmoud Abbas and Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon to promote the latest effort to achieve peace in the Middle East, known as the Roadmap. While this was taking place on the ground in Israel and Palestine, the co-founder of a group called Courage to Refuse spoke in New Haven, Connecticut. Yaniv Ikovits is a 28-year-old paratrooper and a reservist in the Israeli Defense Force. In January 2002, he and a friend organized 51 other reserve combat soldiers and officers who put their name to a statement published in the Israeli newspaper Haaretz. While proclaiming their loyalty to the State of Israel, they announced, quote, "We shall not continue to fight beyond the 1967 borders in order to dominate, expel, starve, and humiliate an entire people," unquote. The number of so-called refuseniks has grown to 542. Many of them, including Ikovits, have served one or more 30-day prison sentences for their refusal to serve in the West Bank and Gaza. Melinda Tuhus spoke with Ikovits about the impact his first military mission to the West Bank had on his moral and political development and his hopes for a peace settlement. He supports a two-state solution, the removal of Israeli settlements outside of Israel, and the division of Jerusalem into East and West.
We received a military mission to go into a Palestinian village and get someone out for inquiry. And we were waking up at night and at 1 o'clock, all through the streets and the houses, and suddenly I started to notice all the features of the Palestinian village, like the smells and the noises and all these kinds of stuff. And it really amazed me, like the normal life of the Palestinians in the village. We reached the house and we spread around it, and we knocked on the door, and an old woman opened up the door, and we went in, we took our man, and the whole family was lying on the floor all together. That's the way they sleep. And there were like 10 children, a grandfather, a grandmother, a lot of mature people, young people. And we took the man that we were supposed to take, and then my commander told me to search the house. So I began searching the house for weapons in the drawers, the closets, and everything. And I remember that the old woman just kept staring at me while I was doing that. And like I felt her her gaze behind my back. The night after, I experienced a dream that was quite similar to the actual mission, and we were walking in the streets of the village, walking all through the houses, but as we advanced, I started to see that the houses are becoming familiar to me, and these were the houses of my neighborhood. And in my dream, I saw that we're going to my house, to my own house, and arresting my own father. And so this was really a powerful, defining moment in my understanding that what I'm doing is actually coming back against me, in the personal level and in the level of Israel, that what we're doing there is coming right back against us. And I think that this is the meaning of the dream, that denying freedom for others is denying freedom for ourselves.
Do you recruit people like yourselves who are reservists, who serve in combatant situations? Do you try to convince other people in your situation to join you to make your movement stronger?
Mm-hmm. Well, we basically, it's a personal decision. I mean, but we do try to advertise the letter in the newspaper. We do it. We make demonstrations and street activities. We are trying to construct a lot of activities, such as conferences all over the universities. We are trying to convince people.
And what's the relationship between your organization and Peace Now and also the International Solidarity Movement, the one that Rachel Corrie was part of, who was killed in Gaza?
Officially, we have nothing to do with them. Not with Peace Now and not with the Solidarity Movement. With Peace Now, we know many people of Peace Now are refuseniks. And we do agree on the political solution, but officially and formally, we don't engage in any mutual activity.
Do you think that they're serving an important role, people coming in from outside of Israel and Palestine and basically bearing witness and risking their lives and sometimes losing their lives?
They're heroes for me. Yeah, if an American or someone from Europe is willing to give up time from his life for his own interest and come to this very, 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 very frightening place and doing what he's doing for peace, then they're heroes. The Rachel Corrie stuff, then we talked about it a lot because it's a good example of the craziness, the insanity of the occupation.
Sharon is saying he's going to dismantle the illegal settlements. Many people believe that all the settlements are illegal. Right. And is that your position?
Well, my personal position, we don't have like a mutual political position. My personal position is that all settlements are illegitimate, that they are, according to the international law, illegitimate. But since there are so many settlements that became like a city, like Ariel has 20,000 people living in it, so I think it will be very hard to dismantle these, but we will have to give other territories instead.
Do you hold out much hope that the roadmap will be successful in reaching any kind of a significant peace agreement and a just agreement between the Palestinians and the Israelis?
Well, the roadmap is nothing new, you know, like Oslo and the roadmap is basically the same. I believe the roadmap is leading to this kind of solution, but the only problem is whether it's going to be implemented by both sides. I think that there's been a slight change in Sharon's position, and the only question is whether he will be determined enough and courageous enough to prevent the settlers from interfering in the peace process and not letting the Hamas achieve whatever they want to achieve, and this is the prevention of peace.
You've said that you visited Auschwitz when you were a teenager. Can you explain what impact that had on you?
In high school, I went to a delegation in the concentration camps. My family was damaged a lot from the Holocaust. My grandfather was in Auschwitz. He survived of Auschwitz, but all of my uncles and grandfather had numbers on their hand. And it was a really big issue in my childhood because it was like very strange for me. I didn't know exactly what was going on there on the one hand. On the other hand, I understood that there's been something so terrible that no one talks about it. On the one hand, you feel very angry. And you are like, you feel a lot of rage and hatred to what people have done to our people, to my family. And they tell you all the time that Israel must not allow it to happen again. On the other hand, when you see what has happened to humanity in Auschwitz, you understand that we should know better than anyone. We must understand that we have a certain moral obligation towards humanity after all that we've been going through. And it seemed to me that these two in the occupied territories contradict each other. And that is the main problem here. That on the one hand, I do want to defend Israel, but on the other hand, what I'm doing there is total violation of human rights.
Yaniv Ikovits, co-founder of Courage to Refuse, speaking to Melinda Tuhus. After a standoff with the Bush administration, UN nuclear experts returned to Iraq over the weekend for the first time since the war to determine the damage caused by looting at Iraqi nuclear facilities. Health experts are concerned that Iraqi civilians living around the nuclear facility emptied barrels of nuclear waste and used them for carrying drinking water when the water pumping station lost power during the war. Meanwhile, peace activists in the U.S. are concerned about another kind of radioactive pollution in Iraq, the result of U.S. military use of depleted uranium. We spoke with Sonny Miller, the director of the Trap Rock Peace Center in Deerfield, Massachusetts.
Don't look, don't tell seems to be the official policy about depleted uranium. We suspect as much as 1,500 tons may have been used, five times the 300 to 350 tons fired into Iraq in 1991. Just for a little perspective on how dangerous that might be, Verna, up in the Northeast here near Albany, New York, as long ago as 1980, there was a factory shut down that had been producing depleted uranium munitions. And they had been found to release 10 times the allowable state limit per month into the atmosphere. A scientist named Len Dietz, I'm so grateful for his help in discerning what that means. The amount of radiation was the equivalent of just two 30-millimeter shells. Think of a fat cigar. Just two shells worth, pulverized, powdered, made of smoke into the atmosphere with 10 times the state allowable limit in New York. It would have been a crime for that factory to continue operations and continue exposing the civilian population. I dread the consequences that we're going to hear about in the years to come.
Well, what about the use of depleted uranium by the U.S.? Is it A, legal to do that, and B, what are the far-reaching ramifications that the use of this would have on not only the population of Iraqis, but also on the U.S. troops exposed to it?
According to Karen Parker of the Subcommittee on Human Rights for the UN, there are four criteria that you would use to see whether a weapon is an illegal weapon, and depleted uranium meets all four characteristics. First of all, it affects not only the military combatants, but the civilian population. Secondly, the effects of it are inhumane. Then over time, the genetic damage that will be caused by the alpha emitters is going to create so many more subtle kinds of genetic damage. It's inhumane. It affects people off the battlefield. It affects people beyond the time of battle. And lastly, it affects the environment. You know, the plants and animals don't deserve this radioactive bombardment, this metal toxicity, any more than those children in Iraq do. And so those four criteria, according to Karen Parker, more than 4 years ago, I believe, she announced her committee's decision that this is an illegal weapon.
Now, is this the type of material that would seep into the ground and eventually into the groundwater and have some sort of lasting effects for the ecosystem?
Yes, the Highway of Death in 1991, that terrible bombardment as people tried to flee, retreating from the battle in Kuwait, that high number of casualties was in the desert area, and nomads did collect scrap metal and bring it in for salvage, and it was recycled and it affected people's lives. But this battle was, as you know, much more in the populated areas near the rivers. Populations flock to the places where there's water. And like the battles in Afghanistan, the waterways in Afghanistan, the tributaries flow into a huge water system that, you know, goes down to India. And whether that's the Tigris and Euphrates or the water systems flowing into India, people draw their water. They use the water there. But we know the water purification systems are in complete disarray in Iraq. Probably the most immediate danger is breathing these materials into the lungs. The radioactive alpha emissions are the most dangerous kind of emission, and really the name depleted uranium is a misnomer.
If this depleted uranium meets all four of the international criteria that determines that it's illegal to use, how is it that the U.S. was able to use this, and is there any kind of are there any kind of legal repercussions from them having done so?
The structures of the U.N., of course, leave most power with the Security Council, and so I'm afraid that decisions there are rather political at the level of the United Nations Environmental Program. That committee has clearly asserted that the U.S. must provide information where depleted uranium munitions were used in the Balkans and in Iraq, so that assessment of the damage and perhaps even evacuation could be undertaken.
Sonny Miller of the Trap Rock Peace Center in Deerfield, Massachusetts. Pacifica's Peace Watch is produced in Washington, D.C. Our producer was Laurel Padgett-Seekins this evening. Our editor, Lona Elias. Our engineer, Granger Helvey. Our associate producer, Angelique Shofar. We had production assistance from Jim Bennett and Otto Hammett of KPFA. Thanks to Pete Caracas, RadioForAll.net, and Shane Rock at WebActive.com for web help. Special thanks also to our consulting producers, Matt Bradley and Sam Husseini. If you'd like to support Peace Watch, we urge you to make a pledge through our secure online website at pacifica.org, or you can send your donations to Pacifica Radio, 2390 Champlain Street Northwest, Washington, D.C., 20009. We'd love to hear your thoughts on the show. Send your feedback to us at peacewatch@pacifica.org. I'm Verna Avery Brown, the executive producer. Thank you for listening.